This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. D.C.-based journalist Jim Loeb works with the Interpress News Service, and he serves on the advisory board of the Foreign Policy in Focus think tank. For over 20 years, he's been keeping an eye on the neoconservative movement. As half a century of American foreign policy undergoes changes that have isolated the U.S. from the rest of the world, Loeb spoke with reporter Pokey Anderson from Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston about the history and philosophical underpinnings of the relatively obscure group of political ideologues he says are now exerting their influence inside the Bush White House.
Tell me how it is that you know about all these folks.
Oh, well, there aren't that many of them, first of all, so it's relatively easy to keep track of them. I mean, talking about a group of, you know, maybe 40 or so individuals who are kind of been Washington players for the last 25 years or more, 30 years in some cases, and whose ideology has kind of defined them as kind of special, and whose political and polemical skills are such that they've always gotten a certain amount of attention, and during Republican administrations have gotten a certain amount of power, but this administration has given them a lot more power than previous ones have.
At some point, somebody said they're kind of in heaven ever since 9/11.
Well, yeah, in some ways, it's like kind of like springtime for the neocons. A lot of the sense of crisis around 9/11 very much parallels their own sense of kind of permanent crisis that the West, and particularly the United States, is always at threat, whether it was with Nazi Germany through World War II, and then the Soviet Union after World War II, and then maybe China in the 90s. 90s was a tough time for them because they couldn't figure out who the next enemy would be. And then 9/11 came along, and they've got an enemy at last, and an enemy around which they can mobilize themselves and mobilize politicians who rely on their advice, and to the greatest extent possible mobilize the public. And that, I think, is what we have seen over the last year and a half.
Talk a little bit about the project for a new American century, because some of the ideas certainly were articulated there, and a lot of people don't know what PNAC is.
Yeah, well, it's not really that big of a thing. It's more of a kind of a front organization. Project for the New American Century came together in 1997, and at that time its charter statement included both neoconservatives, in fact most of them were neoconservatives, but also more traditional Republican right-wing conservatives like Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld, who were charter signatories of PNAC. PNAC's ideas derived from a draft document called the Defense Planning Guidance that was written by Paul Wolfowitz, who was then also in senior ranks of the Pentagon, but not as senior as he is now, and another individual named Scooter Libby, who is now the chief of staff for Dick Cheney and also his chief national security advisor. Back in 1992, after the Gulf War, they wrote a draft planning guidance which leaked to the New York Times, and it created a huge brouhaha in Washington because it suggested that the United States assume the role of preeminent and dominant power, particularly with respect to Eurasia, and that it act more or less as a global policeman. It promulgated a new doctrine of preemption, that is, that you could attack a rising power before it had the power to attack us. It had made no mention of the United Nations, which was particularly remarkable because it was the year before that the Gulf War was waged under the mandate of the United Nations. And it made several other innovations which laid the basis or the foundation for the creation 5 years later of the Project for the New American Century. And it was convened by William Kristol, who's the editor of the Weekly Standard and the chairman of PNAC.
And the Weekly Standard is owned by Rupert Murdoch, correct?
That is true, yeah. It is owned by Rupert Murdoch. And Bob Kagan, who's kind of sidekick. And they're very, very well-known neoconservatives. Bill Kristol's father is Irving Kristol, who's kind of the godfather of the neoconservative movement. And over the following several years, they issued a number of letters in the name of PNAC, in which they advised whoever was sitting as president what they should do with respect to Iraq, what they should do with respect to Taiwan. And what it was really about was a kind of laying of a platform that was kind of waiting there until September 11th, and then it was kind of taken off the shelf.
It's almost like add water.
Well, it's true. And in fact, I think 8 of the signers of the original document went into the Bush administration already before 9/11 at very, very senior levels. And that includes, of course, Cheney and Rumsfeld, but also Wolfowitz and Libby, who is a very quiet but very important player in the national security area within the Bush administration, Elliot Abrams on the National Security Council, and a few other people who were quite senior. So they pretty much had their people in place, and those who remained outside had in some ways quasi-official positions. I'm thinking in particular, for example, of Richard Perle, who was made chairman of the Defense Policy Board. He was one of the original creators of PNAC, one of the charter members. Indeed, his offices are just 5 floors above PNAC's offices, which PNAC's offices are on the 5th floor of a building, and American Enterprise Institute, where Perle hangs out, are on the 10th, 11th, and 12th floors. And it's kind of the neocon central in Washington, D.C., if not the entire universe, in that particular building. So they were extremely well-placed when 9/11 happened, and they already had kind of a vision and a plan for what they wanted to do, both globally and particularly in the Gulf area in the Middle East.
Now they some of these people had already written to President Clinton in, what, 98, saying, hey, we think you ought to do something about Iraq.
Yeah, well, these people have consistently called for regime change. It's just that in 1998 when they published a letter together, in fact, these people are members of multiple organizations, and all these organizations produced letters in 1998 calling for regime change in Iraq. And they have consistently believed that the earlier President Bush made a major strategic error in not going all the way to Baghdad. And they have long supported regime change in Baghdad. This was nothing particularly new. It's just that it had more political momentum in 98, and of course after September 11th it had even more political momentum. And they were able to realize their dream.
Charles Krauthammer, a Washington Post columnist who's been identified as a neocon, has written, "The fact is no country has been as dominant culturally, economically, technologically, and militarily in the history of the world since the late Roman Empire as the U.S." So he's like right out there in front with this talk of empire. And certainly PNAC is pretty much right out there on Empire Building. And yet, the kind of information, quote, that we get from the mass media and from the Bush administration really has to do with building fear in the American populace that, you know, somebody's going to run us over. How can that be? Is it, you know, behind the scenes we're an empire and, you know, out in the public arena, everybody's running like, you know, duck for cover. What's that all about?
Well, Krauthammer is a neocon. Indeed, he's signed at least one of PNAC's letters. I mean, he's very tight with the group, and in many ways, he's a mouthpiece for the neocons in the Pentagon. He often attacks the State Department and the CIA, which are seen as realists that are opposed to the neocons' greater ambitions. I think that it's the same as in if you go back 20 years to Nicaragua. And on the one hand, the U.S. insisted that Nicaragua was a ramshackle, failing little third-world tropical country that really, could hardly do anything at all. And on the other hand, it was portrayed as a serious threat to U.S. national security interests that, you know, it was only a 2-day trip between Managua and Harlingen, Texas, and they were coming to get us. Mm-hmm. I think it's a certain mentality. I think one of the best people probably to analyze that, not being myself a psychologist or a psychoanalyst, would be Krauthammer, who has a training in both fields and is not a historian.
There's been a buzz, apparently, that Leo Strauss was is the guy who supplied the philosophical underpinnings for some of the neocons and their offspring. And according to Shadia Drury, who wrote about Leo Strauss in a book called Leo Strauss and the American Right, she said that his philosophy was, you want a crowd you can manipulate like putty, as kind of opposed to the traditional ideas of liberal democracy. And you've written about this. Any comments on the whole Leo Strauss buzz?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's only just kind of happened in the last few weeks that people have kind of begun to pay attention. Seymour Hersh wrote an article in the New Yorker, and there was another article in the New York Times last week, which pointed out that a number of very influential people, both within the administration and outside of it, and in particular Paul Wolfowitz within the administration, as well as a couple of other people in the Pentagon, and William Kristol and his father Irving, outside the administration, were Straussians, that is, were followers of Leo Strauss. I'm just beginning to explore into this, and I am not a political philosopher by any means, but the sense of it is he was, Leo Strauss died in 1973. He taught for many years at the University of Chicago. He came to this country from Germany. He was a German-Jewish refugee in 1938. The question is, what about these people's thinking kind of reflects what Leo Strauss thought? And Leo Strauss thought, for one thing, that there were all kinds of hidden meanings in the world and in text, and that it took enormous amount of study that only a very few people were capable of to understand what these truths were. And so this was a notion that harked back to Plato, which is that only the elite can really understand the things as they truly are, and hence only an elite, a very small number of people, in Plato's words, philosophers or philosopher kings, should rule, and everyone else should follow. And he was a big admirer of that notion. He had his own twists about that, on that. And he believed that you give everybody else religion. And one thing that's very interesting about neocons is how much they have supported particularly fundamentalist Christianity, despite the fact that most neocons, by and large, are Jewish. And the notion out of Strauss is that, just like with Marx, religion is the opiate of the peoples. Only Marx thought that was a bad thing, and Strauss thought it was a good thing, because religion, if people really believe in the religion in which they're brought up, that will be the way they get morality, and that will keep society together. That and having an enemy outside the society will make societies that would otherwise kind of bicker or divide, would make them unite and will keep them in line, so that the elite, who should be doing the ruling, can serve the best interests of the entire society or polity.
Investigative journalist Jim Loeb speaking with Pokey Anderson, that segment produced by Renee Feltz at Pacific Station KPFT in Houston. In remarks delivered at the annual Peace Officers Memorial Service today in Washington, D.C., President Bush told those gathered to commemorate slain officers that, quote, law enforcement officers know that evil is real and evil has servants of its own. And he went on to say that evil must always be opposed. Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, in comments delivered last week at a conference held at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, entitled War on Terrorism or Assault on Human Rights, takes note of Bush's use of the word evil and how religious demagoguery is shaping American foreign policy.
This Iraq war was an example of messianic militarism. Bush believes, he honestly believes, that God himself put him in the Oval Office, when in fact we know it was William Rehnquist. He does believe that with God on his side and a B-2 bomber with angel wings in the sky, that he can rid the world of evil. And that is a very, very troubling and dangerous concept. I mean, the man has a crude mind. He has only two categories in the mind, good and evil, us and them. And this is going to lead, unfortunately, to more wars. He alerted us to that fact with that great Top Gun speech he gave when he said that, you know, any nation that allies with terrorism and has or aspires to getting weapons of mass destruction will be confronted. I don't think he's going to confront these nations prior to the reelection campaign, though if it looks like he's losing, he might. What I fear most is he's going to get reelected, and then upon reelection, he's going to wage one war after another. He does believe that Kim Jong-il in North Korea is evil incarnate, and he loathes Kim Jong-il, as he told Bob Woodward, and he practically gets apoplectic at mention of the guy's name. He called him a pygmy, which was enlightened. And even though the Pentagon has said that within the first 5 days of another war on the Korean Peninsula, a million people will die, Bush may be prepared to do that. It's not Bush who's going to die. So I think we need to be very mindful of what's going on. We also need to listen to the rhetoric from Bush, because it's really one lie upon another. During the Iraq War and the lead up to the Iraq War, and even in that speech the other day on that aircraft carrier, again, Saddam was an ally of Osama bin Laden. You know, for months and months he's been trying to glue the beard of Osama bin Laden under the chin of Saddam Hussein. It never really caught. Never really stuck, but, you know, it stuck with a lot of the American people. That was the crazy thing. You know, 40-45% of the American people thought they, you know, Saddam Hussein was behind September 11th. And so he gets away with it. He uses a term, American justice. He used it in a State of the Union speech. It doesn't refer to the system of American justice that we hold in such high esteem that the ACLU fights for all the time. No, his definition of American justice is really vigilante justice, frontier justice, extrajudicial killing. And so he says, we will make the terrorists come to terms with American justice, or we will bring them to American justice. That doesn't mean bring them to court. That means to kill them. And there is, again, a messianic or religious overtone to that, because it's like the Lord's terrible swift sword, that kind of justice. That's the justice that Bush talks about. So we need to be very careful about all of this. I want to talk about the new McCarthyism. It's not a perfect analogy. There's no perfect analogy. It's not as bad today as it was in the worst days of McCarthyism, unless you're an immigrant. Then it is exactly as bad. But still, there are parallels between this period and the McCarthy period. And so following September 11th, I started to hear one story after another. So I wrote them up in this cover story of the January 2002 issue of The Progressive called The New McCarthyism. And a couple stories there, I think, shed some light, because I think in the particulars are interesting, and in the particulars we can see the general. A.J. Brown, 19-year-old woman, Durham Tech, North Carolina, waiting at her date a Friday afternoon at about 5 o'clock, and comes a knock on her door. Secret Service agents are there. We hear you have an anti-American poster on your wall. She said, I don't have an anti-American poster on your wall. She doesn't open the door. Her mom's in the service, by the way, and she tried to reach her mom, and she couldn't reach her mom. So she opens the door a crack and says, no, we don't have anything there. And they wouldn't go away. And they kept looking, and they could see a poster on her wall. It was an anti-death penalty poster. It was a poster depicting George W. Bush with hangman's noose and about, you know, three dozen people that he hanged back there, because remember, Bush put 130-some people to death in Texas. And finally they went away. And they called her 3 days later and said, what's your phone number, after just calling her, and asked her about some of her nicknames and things like that. I mean, that is really serious harassment. So I got a lot of those stories in here. You know, there's one guy in San Francisco, he's working out at the gym. He's having a discussion with the guy next to him who's lifting weights about the Afghan war. And the guy says, you know, I oppose this Afghan war. The next day he gets visited by the FBI. Or this other guy. This guy is a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer in Indiana. Gave up his journalism career to become an environmentalist. And Dick Cheney was coming to town. You know, Dick Cheney only surfaces to break a tie in the Senate or to raise money for Republican candidates. He was doing the latter here in Indiana. He was visiting this small town. And the former Pulitzer Prize winner was outside the city county building on the public sidewalk with a sign that says, Dick Cheney, 19th century energy man. Cheney was across the street raising funds for the Republican legislator. The guy with the Dick Cheney, 19th century energy man, arrested and kept overnight till Cheney was out of town. I mean, this is something that happens in royal times. You know, the king can't see any protests. That was just amazing to me.
Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, speaking at a conference held at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Special thanks to Mark Weaver at community radio station WMBR for production assistance with that segment. With the Los Angeles Police Department recently declaring graffiti a form of terrorism, several artists in the area have taken advantage of the increased focus on their work. They're using their talents to educate their fellow Californians about their perceptions of American foreign policy, and more specifically, their strong disagreement monuments over the U.S.-led war in Iraq. One such artist stepping up is Mir One. Recently, Mir One created a mural with no sketches, what is known in the hip-hop world as freestyling. He created in front of a 76 gas station in the Echo Park neighborhood of Los Angeles. And last weekend, the unveiling of the mural took place. Fidel Rodriguez of Pacifica Station KPFK stopped by the corner of Sunset and Alvarado and spoke to a variety of people about their thoughts on the piece, as well as Mir One's insights on the power of art to inspire. He presents this musical mix.
Click, click, click. Brrr, click. I'm sorry. The government you have elected is inoperative. Click.
We spotted two suspects. Suspects are armed. I repeat, the suspects are armed and dangerous.
Shoot them. Take them down.
There's two blacks and a Hispanic in a Monte Carlo, sir. What do you want me to do?
These two black guys look suspicious.
Arrest them.
What do you think about this mural?
I think that it's really cool.
Why do you think it's cool?
Actually, I think it's nice. Well, I think it's a mural about Iraq, and they're showing you what's happening in it. Iraq. There's happening like a lot of like helicopters and missiles and tanks coming down right in their home. They don't have nothing else to have in their. They are yelling to have no more war. And there's a lady who's holding a girl with a baby has a little drip crying.
Do you think war is good?
No.
How come?
Because you kill people in war. I'm 7 and my name is Cuauhtémoc.
Can I get your first impressions of this piece by Mir One?
It's fantastic. It's very colorful. Signature colors of blue and orange. And it catches your eyes. There's tons of messages in it. So it's great. Messages. There's just chaos. Chaos and... it's out of your control if we don't do something about it. So we have to stand up and be active about what's happening in the world. But it's a challenge also because all these leaders have money and power, and it's like these little people don't matter to them at all. So it's a big message out there.
On the corner of Sunset and Alvarado, actually at 76th Station. What do you think about this piece, man?
Well, once again, man, Mir doesn't disappoint, you know. That's why I like this guy's work, man. He always takes his time, not just to, you know, make a fresh painting where people can look at it and say, oh, look at that art, but something that they can take with them, you know what I mean? Especially people who aren't aware of what's happening, which is 85% of the people, as we know. So when people can, you know, because I think everyday people can look at this and take something from it that, you know, that they're not getting, man. You know, people watching TV, reading these newspapers out here, you know, getting this mass information, this such a small point of view on what's really happening. So it's important for, you know, artists like Mir, other heads that are doing things, trying to bring you an alternative view of what's happening. You know what I mean? So I think it's perfect, man, you know. And so, you know, a lot of people got ill feeling about graffiti. That just lets you know, too, man, people are unhappy with the situation they're living in. You know what I mean? So people are really willing and open to learn something new, man. So Mir One always putting that down, man. So just try to support it.
Powerful. Very beautiful. It was very captivating, especially the central image of the woman and the child, the glowing halo around. It's very strong. You just want to just keep focusing on that. But then there's also more chaos going on around, which is reality. It shouldn't be like that, but we have to face reality, I guess. Yeah. And this mural is just kind of focusing on the hope that, you know, people will stop and pay attention and see, you know, that this is what's really going on. You know, like, wake up, you know.
Mir, can you let our audience know how you got started in this art game?
Well, always looking for a creative outlet, always getting into trouble, always looking to, you know, it's sometimes you got a hard time breathing, it seems, in life. Like, it's hard to breathe, you know, the world just crowds in on you. So, art is definitely like a relief, you know, take a few hundred pounds off the chest when you do some art. So that was how I got started, was just plugging into something that I could enjoy and live on. And from there, I kind of continued to get in trouble. So I've always said this a million times, with graffiti art, it really is a savior to me. I was throwing rocks at cars, breaking windows on the highways, breaking and entering businesses and stealing VCRs to make money, stealing bicycles to sell them for whatever I needed at the time. And as a white boy in the center of Hollywood, growing up in a Latino neighborhood, and I idolized and romanticized the gangs, and I was slowly becoming one of the, you know, many infamous gangs in Los Angeles, trying to join everything from, you know, just being idolizing 18th Street and wanting to be a member of the TMC Los Magos gang, and having homeboys from Los TRS, Rascals, and Cardinales, and, you know, these are all my homies. I grew up with these heads, and you know, my homeboy Skate One, before he passed away, told me that he's like, dude, you know, you're way too talented and you're a white boy and you got to remember your place here. He's like, you really, it's not your path in life to be gangbanging. You know, you gotta get out of that shit because you need to took out. You know, I'm not a fighter. So I from there embraced graffiti much deeper, because graffiti, I could still break that window, disobey the system, go against the grain, and yet it was in a creative process. It wasn't quite as destructive to myself, you know. It's actually elevating. It's my savior. It brought me to the place I'm at now. It keeps me going, like fuel.
I mean, that fuel obviously has gotten to a point where it's you're definitely breaking boundaries of the mind. You know what I mean? I mean, you're taking human beings to another level, being able to see what you're doing. Can you tell the listener a little bit about this project that you've done right here in front of the 76 station?
Yeah, I kind of smoothed my style right off their color of their logo emblem of the lovely contrasting blue and orange. So I used that as a color palette, since their wall at the Labor Fruit 33 and a third books here is a blue building. I decided to use orange for my background and begin building a conscious perspective and a dialogue off of the, you know, the situation our government has placed the world in right now. And I'm just dissatisfied, and that's where the mural stems from, is dissatisfaction with the quality of life, you know, and the limitation I feel as a human being to have a world I want to see, you know, manifest. So this is you know, one way I feel that I can reach out to people, you know.
You want to let people know about your website and how they can get a hold of you through email?
Yeah, just put your fingers to the tapping on that keyboard and hit up mirone.com, M-E-A-R-O-N-E.com, and check me out. And you can always contact me through there.
Thank you, Mir.
Graffiti artist Mir Juan, who recently unveiled his provocative graffiti mural regarding the war and occupation of Iraq. If you're in the Los Angeles area, you can see it at the corner of Sunset Boulevard and Alvarado Street in the Echo Park neighborhood. Special thanks to Fidel Rodriguez at Pacifica Station KPFK for preparing that piece. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adel Hamid of KPFA and Benta Berkland. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit WebActive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.